Episode 84, Abraham Lincoln and the Secession of the South. Hi, my name is Clayton Mills. Welcome to A Short Walk Through Our Long History, a podcast where we look at the events of history and examine how those events shaped our modern world. Well, here we are, about to watch the House divide against itself, and it's not going to be pretty. And I have to say, as I start this episode, that I really feel like we're getting somewhere in this podcast. I mean, we're at the brink of war. We've been building up to the Civil War for a long time now, and here we are about to see the United States fall apart. The actual fighting is going to begin next episode, and then I think we're going to linger on the Civil War topic for a few episodes. I mean, we lingered on Rome for 12 episodes, so there is a precedent, but don't worry, it won't be that long. Last episode, I talked about Kansas, John Brown, and the Dred Scott case, and now we are going to get to the events that really end up dividing the country, and so we get to talk about John Brown again. At the same time that Kansas was bleeding, there was a contest, though, going on in Illinois for one of the U.S. Senate seats. The current holder of the seat was Stephen A. Douglas, who I mentioned last episode, because he was the author of the Kansas-Nebraska Act. Now, Douglas was a Democrat, but like I said, he wasn't pro-slavery, but nor was he anti-slavery. He thought each state ought to be able to make up its own mind, and the federal government should not be making any state do something that its constituents didn't want. Now, Douglas's opponent for the Senate seat for Illinois was our good friend Abraham Lincoln. Lincoln was part of the new Republican Party, and he was clearly anti-slavery. In the course of the 1858 Senate campaign between the two of them, the two men had 7 public debates in different parts of Illinois, some of which have actually been entirely transcribed and are available online even now. They were both very good debaters, and their debates became news and also grew to be very well attended. Now, Douglas, for his part, stuck to his point that the federal government should not have the authority to go against the sovereignty of any state, which in most cases I would agree with. But Lincoln made this point, which I also agree with. If slavery isn't wrong, then nothing is wrong. I mean, that's a pretty clear way of stating the problem. Slavery was a moral wrong, and it went against one of the other founding principles of the Republic, of the United States. States sovereignty was one of the founding principles and a very important principle, but so was the idea that all men are created equal and that they have the inherent rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And slavery clearly was the opposite of those ideals. Portions of the debates between Lincoln and Douglas were reprinted all over the United States, and the attention helped Abraham Lincoln's name be known throughout the country. However, it didn't help him win the election. Douglas went on to hold his Senate seat, even though the popular vote was slightly in favor of Lincoln. But it was the Illinois legislature that decided its senators back in those days, so they picked Douglas despite the popular vote. Now, just as a quick aside, the choosing of senators was always done by the state legislatures until the 17th Amendment, which was passed in 1913, which switched the process to statewide popular elections. I have to say, this was another major hit to the system of checks and balances that were set up in the Constitution. Back when the legislatures chose their senators, it was clearly each senator's job to represent the overall interests of their state and to protect the interests of the state at the federal level. If a senator wasn't doing a good job of representing the state's interests, he could be recalled by the legislature or replaced at the next election. After it was switched to a popular election, the senator's job changed, and the senator's job became just being popular and keeping enough voters happy that the senator would be reelected. It really changed the dynamics of the Senate, and it created our current miasma of senators for life, who are really only there protecting their own positions and getting rich on the process. Does anyone really think that ancient relics like Mitch McConnell or Nancy Pelosi were actually looking out for the interests of their own state and trying to protect their own state's interests from the federal government? No, they're there to encourage the growth of the federal government at the expense of the rights of the states. And they're there to fatten their own wallets and protect the interests of the rich donors who put them in the office and helped keep them in office. Anyway, back before we lost that important check and balance, the state legislatures made the final choice of their senators, and in Illinois in 1858, they chose Stephen A. Douglas. By the way, I have no idea why he's called Stephen A. Douglas, not just Stephen Douglas. It's kind of like John Wilkes Booth or Lee Harvey Oswald. We always use their middle names too. I'll get to John Wilkes Booth soon enough, but Lee Harvey Oswald is going to have to wait for a bit. But the really important upshot for Lincoln and the Lincoln-Douglas debates is that Lincoln became well known in the South as a Republican who was firmly against slavery. His name was known, and he became this kind of universally hated figure in the South, even though he had never even been to the South and had, up to that point, not actually done anything at all that would in any way hurt the South. But they all universally hated him. Why is this going to be important? Because in 2 years, Abraham Lincoln is going to run for president. But before we get to the firestorm of the 1860 presidential election, we have to take a look at the match that lit the fuse that's going to eventually light the fire. And this brings us back to our crazy friend, John Brown. After his raid on some pro-slavery families, none of whom actually owned slaves at the time, back in Kansas, he went back to New York. But he continued to be involved in abolitionist meetings and activities. He apparently met Frederick Douglass and Harriet Tubman and was a big deal within the Underground Railroad. So he began to make a plan for a raid into the South with the intent of causing a slave uprising. So in early 1859, Brown participated in some Underground Railroad raids into the South just to free slaves, but he had bigger plans. So he recruited over 20 men, including once again a couple of his sons, and on October 16th of 1859, Brown led a raid into Virginia with three objectives. First, they were planning to capture Colonel Lewis Washington, who was a great nephew of George Washington, and they were going to hold him as a hostage. Lewis Washington and his family were still slave owners in Virginia. Second, Brown and his team were going to capture the U.S. Federal Armory in Harper's Mill, Virginia. An armory is just a building where they store guns and ammo, right? And third, they were going to use the weapons and ammo from the armory to supply a slave uprising in Virginia. Now, history has debated whether John Brown's plan was completely insane, and also whether John Brown himself was completely insane. I mean, if you're going to try to instigate a slave uprising, shouldn't you maybe notify the slaves that they were supposed to be uprising? Brown didn't do that. This was in the days before social media, obviously, so how were the slaves supposed to know that they were supposed to rise up and come to Harper's Ferry and get the guns and ammo that they needed for an uprising? News traveled kind of slowly in those days. Brown didn't plan for that. Anyway, Brown and his team rode down into Harper's Ferry, Virginia, and they split up into two groups. One team went and captured Lewis Washington, and the other team went and captured the Federal Armory in Harper's Ferry. Lewis Washington was brought to the armory, where the team had several other hostages. The team also stopped a train that was bound for Washington to keep it from alerting the federal government. In stopping the train, Brown's group killed its first victim, a baggage handler from the train who refused the orders of Brown's men. Now, ironically, the baggage handler was a free black man, the very kind of person that Brown was trying to help. The train was eventually allowed to depart, and the train employees did, of course, alert both their owners and the federal authorities when they got to Washington. The next day, President James Buchanan ordered a team of U.S. Marines to go to Harper's Ferry and subdue the uprising. The Marines were led by, wait for it, none other than Colonel Robert E. Lee. Is that irony or destiny? I don't know. Lee's men, plus some local militia, surrounded the armory. Lee offered Brown an opportunity to surrender, but Brown refused. Meanwhile, all around Harper's Ferry, the slaves, who were supposed to rise up, diligently refused to rise up, probably because they hadn't heard about any uprising, and they didn't know they were supposed to. They had no idea. Late on the 17th, Lee ordered his men to attack, and they captured Brown and all of his men alive. The hostages were all freed, and there was, of course, no slave insurrection. But even though the local slaves did not hear about the raid on Harper's Ferry, pretty soon, everyone else in the South had heard about John Brown and the abolitionists who had attacked the South trying to create a slave uprising. A slave uprising was something that many, many people in the South worried about, and rightly so. In many states and on many plantations, there were more slaves than there were owners. And if the slaves rose up, then the Biden administration would be quickly overthrown. I mean, if the slaves rose up, then the Southern plantation owners would be quickly overthrown. And as I said last episode, there are always more poor people than there are rich people. So a slave uprising was a very real fear for the people of the South, which in a backhanded way sort of, again, shows how wrong slavery is. I mean, if you're afraid that the people are going to rise up against you and kill you, it means you've been mistreating them, and it's not right. But for the people of the South, the idea that the North was sending down bands of armed mercenaries who would do what John Brown did, well, that scared them a lot. The South, overall, was really feeling like the North was trying to force them to change their lives, to change their ways. And for a variety of reasons, the South did not like it. Antagonism towards the North was at an all-time high. Then came the presidential election of 1860. Did I mention that the antagonism was high? This election is going to take it even higher. The election of 1860 is going to be the straw that breaks the camel's back, or it's going to be the final thing that divides the House so that it cannot stand. Choose your own analogy. There are four candidates in the presidential election of 1860. The Republican candidate was, of course, Abraham Lincoln, whom everyone in the South saw as the epitome of Northern anti-slavery, anti-Southern sentiment. There was a candidate from the Constitutional Union Party named John Bell. John Bell was from Kentucky, and he was a constitutional conservative, as was the party, but they were neutral about slavery. The Constitutional Union Party's platform was that they didn't take a firm position on slavery, but they did promise to defend the Constitution. Now, the Democratic Party had two candidates, William Breckinridge, also of Kentucky, and Stephen A. Douglas of Illinois. Breckinridge was clearly pro-slavery and in favor of adding more slave states to the Union, but Douglas was in favor of letting the states decide. Now, this brings up a problematic tension for the states' rights Democrats. The Democrats were in favor of states' rights, but that also meant that the new states kind of ought to have the right to decide for themselves. And everyone knew that most of these new states, if left to themselves, would just come in as free states. In the new territories and the new states, there just wasn't much of an economic incentive to have slaves. Most of the settlers of those states were homestead farmers who owned and worked their own land, and they wouldn't have needed slaves or even wanted them. And most of those people did not actually want slavery for their state. So if you followed Douglas's logic that the states should decide for themselves, well, pretty soon, most of the Senate, and eventually the House of Representatives as well, would be anti-slavery. And if that happened, then the whole federal government would probably outlaw slavery sometime in the near future. So the Southern Democrats didn't really support Stephen A. Douglas, but this split the Democratic vote. When the election results were in, Kentucky and John Bell won three states. Kentucky, Virginia, and Tennessee. Stephen A. Douglas won only one state, Missouri. He didn't even win his own home state of Illinois. And notice that all of these states are all border states in between the North and the South. William Breckinridge of Kentucky won all of the rest of the Southern states, in most cases by a wide margin. Abraham Lincoln won all of the Northern states, also in most cases by a wide margin. Lincoln did not win a single electoral vote from any Southern states. In some states, he didn't even receive a single popular vote. So when the electoral votes were counted, Lincoln won handily, despite not carrying a single Southern state. You should look at a map of the election online. It's really clearly polarized between North and South. And so the people of the South were furious. Despite having clearly not voted for Biden, he was their president. I mean, despite clearly not having voted for Lincoln, he was now their president. With the North set to control the presidency and also the Senate, and soon the House, the South was very clearly worried about their prospects. Lincoln's election was in November of 1860, and at the beginning of December, South Carolina called together an official assembly to discuss the possibility of seceding from the Union. By December 20th, they had passed an ordinance stating that they had seceded from the United States. Imagine that. That's crazy. They just stepped right out. And on December 24th, they passed a declaration of their reasons for secessions. The Declaration of Secession starts like this. We, the people of the state of South Carolina, in convention, assembled, do declare and ordain, and it is hereby declared and ordained that the ordinance adopted by us in convention on the 23rd day of May in the year of our Lord, 1788, whereby the Constitution of the United States of America was ratified, and also all its acts and parts of acts of the General Assembly of this state, ratifying amendment of such said Constitution, are hereby repealed, and that the Union now subsisting between South Carolina and the other states under the name of the United States of America is hereby dissolved. Whoa, they just dissolved the Union. Crazy. Wow. So not even 100 years after joining the United States, South Carolina has decided it is no longer part of those United States. It has dissolved the Union. Six other Southern states were also having secession conventions, and they followed South Carolina in short order. Those other states were Mississippi, Florida, Alabama, Georgia, Louisiana, and Texas. All of these states held formal conventions with elected representatives, and then they all voted internally, democratically, to remove themselves from the United States. So this raises, obviously, an important constitutional question. Did these states, and do these states currently, constitutionally have the right to secede? The Constitution itself does not at all speak of secession. It makes no provisions for it, but nor does it disallow it. Now here's an important quote from the 10th Amendment of the Constitution. The powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited by it to the states, are reserved to the states respectively or to the people. So that is, the powers that are not clearly given to the federal government in the Constitution are reserved for the people and the states. So since the Constitution doesn't say anything about secession, I mean, it kind of sounds like constitutionally that the states have the right, the power, to secede if they choose. And all the Confederate states did follow legislative principles. That is, they had duly elected people at the conferences that chose to secede, and then their legislatures all backed the secessions. Although, to be fair and even, that was all just the white voters, and the black slaves didn't get any say in the matter at all. And in some states, like South Carolina, the slaves actually outnumbered the white voters. So had everyone, including the slaves, been allowed to vote, it might very well have actually gone differently. In any case, the rest of the United States did not recognize the right of these states to secede. And from the northern and federal points of view, these seven states were now in active rebellion against the duly elected government. And the north and the federal side has a point there too. It wasn't like the South seceded before the election. They seceded after Lincoln was elected. They had participated in the election, but they had lost. If every state had the freedom to just up and leave if their candidate wasn't elected, well, the Union wouldn't have lasted very long at all. I mean, if you participate in the election as a state, well, you're kind of legally bound by its results, aren't you? Unless, of course, there was fraud and cheating, then maybe you have a case. But no one was accusing Lincoln of having cheated, like Biden did. Lincoln, at least, won fair and square. But nearly all of the South saw this as being worthy of them removing themselves from the Union. And it's worth pointing out that the first seven states seceded before Lincoln had even taken office. He hadn't even done anything yet, and they were already seceding. The states of the South saw that their interests were not being represented at the federal level, so rather than taking other options like withdrawing their senators or filing protests or some kind of other action like withholding their taxes, something like that that's happening within the existing political structure, they chose to just up and leave. But maybe they felt like the time had come to leave a system that they saw was no longer representing them. And that is exactly what the Founding Fathers had done after the long train of abuses and usurpations. At some point, you just lose faith in the current system and you feel like it is beyond not just representing you, it is actively antagonistic towards you. But am I talking about the South in 1860 or the middle class today? You decide. Anyway, after the first seven states had seceded, they began to meet in Montgomery, Alabama to form a new country. The convention in Montgomery soon wrote and published a constitution for the seven states, loosely based on the U.S. Constitution, but being more explicit in reserving power and sovereignty to the individual states. These seven states called themselves the Confederate States of America, and they named Jefferson Davis of Mississippi as their interim president. To the north of the first seven states were the states that formed the border between the North and the South, and soon four of those states also voted to secede, and they all eventually joined the Confederacy. They were motivated, these four states, in part by one of Lincoln's first acts as president, when he called for the enlistment of at least 75,000 new men into the U.S. Army. This, much more than his actual election, signaled the intents of the federal government. The U.S. government was not going to let the southern states simply walk away, and if it took force, well, it was going to take force. So after that, Virginia, Tennessee, North Carolina, and Arkansas also seceded. By far the biggest deal here, of course, is Virginia. It was still one of the largest and wealthiest states, and its economy was very dependent on slavery. After these four states had seceded, the lines were basically drawn. And people all over the formerly united states had to choose sides. In some places, especially near the borders, there were people from the same family that supported different sides, and there were families that were split across different states. It was becoming a division of brother against brother, of families divided. It was indeed a house divided against itself. So the South seceded, and it began to arm itself, even as the North began to arm itself. But there was this important thorny problem that was already in place, even from before South Carolina's secession. In many places in the South, there were Union, or Northern, forts occupied by Union soldiers rather than by locals. And the Union wanted to keep those forts. But the people of the South saw those forts as their own land, and the Union soldiers were seen as an occupying army. And this tension is about to boil over on a small island in the harbor of Charleston, South Carolina. Join me next episode as shots are fired and we go to Fort Sumter and watch the beginning of the bloodiest war in American history. I don't usually comment on my outro music, but this one is from a video that was shot at the concluding ceremonies of the 150th anniversary of the Battle of Gettysburg. Every year they have a reenactment of the battle, and after the battle, at the closing ceremony, a live folk band played this song, Dixie, and the crowd went wild. You should look it up on YouTube. It's an interesting moment. Anyway, see you next episode.